Welcome to a brand new season of Unicorn Leader Interviews on the C-Suite podcast. Over the last few years, we've interviewed 35 CEOs and founders of billion-dollar startups. Obviously, I urge you to go back and listen to that archive of great content, but not before listening to this episode, of course. My name is Russell Goldsmith, and together with Debbie West, to kick off this new season of guests, we're thrilled to be joined online from Denver, Colorado, by Sami Ikonen, the CEO and co-founder of Virta Health, the leader in type 2 diabetes reversal and creator of a new standard in medical care for people living with type 2 diabetes, pre-diabetes or obesity. Founded in 2014, the company achieved unicorn status in December 2020 and it hit a $2 billion valuation in July 2023. Welcome to the show, Sami. Can we start by you telling us a little bit more about Virta Health, but also why are you so passionate about this mission to reverse type 2 diabetes?
Yeah, well, first of all, Russ and Debbie, thank you so much for having me here today. Very much appreciated. Yeah, well, as you already eloquently mentioned in that beautiful introduction, we at Virta Health, we are on a mission to reverse type 2 diabetes in 100 million people. And I emphasize the word reverse because traditionally this horrible disease has been managed as a chronic and progressive disease, but indeed, we can nutritionally reverse type 2 diabetes and eliminate the need for medications. So that's what we do. But you asked, like, how did this come about? Yeah, I come from outside of healthcare, you know, grew up in Finland, came to America, built actually another company that went public and gained a unicorn status as well called Trulia. So that was all outside of healthcare because Trulia was an online real estate marketplace. So my path to healthcare and solving type 2 diabetes obesity was kind of accidental. And if you don't mind, I'll just share briefly the story. So I always thought, as a relatively high-level athlete, triathlete, and I won the world championships in triathlon age group, I always thought obesity and type 2 diabetes, it's kind of personal choice. I don't have it. I'm an athlete. I exercise a lot. I eat healthy. It's personal choice. You can't solve that. It's personal choice. You eat too much. So everything in my mind changed when, after all my sports accomplishment around 2012, 2013, I found out that I was actually personally on my way to developing type 2 diabetes, and I already had pre-diabetes. And obviously, in my mind, it just didn't make any sense. I was lean, I was fit, I was exercising. And so I started asking questions. Wait a second. What's happening here to me? Is there something we don't know about this disease that could be looked at differently? And sort of making a long story short, I met with a couple of scientists and we can dive into that, how that happened. But what I discovered was, one, obviously I was wrong. The type 2 diabetes and obesity is not a personal choice. It's a metabolic disease. But then more importantly, secondly, while traditional diet and exercise programs have failed, if you can use nutrition in a way that you eliminate hunger and cravings and you manipulate the biochemistry in a right way, you can nutritionally, contrary to what we're told, reverse type 2 diabetes and also help people lose weight effortlessly. So I just became convinced that nutrition is the key. And based on all the evidence I saw, it's not about how much you eat, it's about what you eat. And if you manipulate that in the right individualized way, you can, quote unquote, cure or reverse obesity and type 2 diabetes. So that kind of pulled me in and I said, wait a second. I built one company. It was a 10-year journey, but this feels like larger than life opportunity to help not just millions, but hopefully hundreds of millions of people become metabolically healthy. And, you know, here we are another 10 years later. We've done that. Of course, it's still day one for us, but yeah, that's what we're doing.
Before you did all that research, were you concerned that it was going to impact on your sports career?
Well, absolutely not. I thought I was fine and healthy, you know, lean and exercising and winning competitions. So I personally thought ahead of time that, you know, nothing's wrong with me until I realized that I wasn't metabolically healthy. And then after that, as I kind of learned how the nutrition, if you eat the wrong things, no matter how much you exercise, you can become metabolically unhealthy. You can make certain adjustments, be equally high performance athletes still afterwards.
So how about, you know, in terms of like deciding to launch Virta Health, how did that all come about then?
Well, I should say that I was very excited about the prospect of taking this quote-unquote secret to the world and helping millions, hundreds of millions of people struggling with type 2 diabetes and obesity. So I did have this urge of like, oh my God. And, you know, my background in technology was a key part of scaling this through telemedicine. So I felt like I had unique skills. So I was very excited about the idea. However, there were sort of obviously a couple of obstacles. One was to find the right scientist to help us and help me and help Virta on this mission. And then the second obstacle I quite frankly had after 10 years of building another high growth company, taking public and everything, I was pretty sort of trigger shy. I thought, oh my God, am I going to jump into another? It's a hard journey most of the time. And am I going to jump into this? And so we could talk about this at length, but what ended up happening was I thought, well, the first step that I'm going to do after realizing how important part nutrition plays in metabolic health is, I want to build awareness for kids, even if I don't end up starting a company. And let's row boat from California to Hawaii, which, you know, it's 2,700 nautical miles. So it's a long journey. And to raise awareness about the dangers of bad nutrition, in particular sugar. And so as part of preparation for that journey, I met this scientist, Dr. Stephen Finney, who then ended up becoming my Virta Health co-founder, because I wanted his help to sort of figure out the nutrition for the journey. So that kind of solved the one piece that I found him and his science colleague, Dr. Jeff Volek. So I had the perfect team and a co-founder. And then finally, I'll finish quickly. The second piece in my mind was like, do I really want to? Like, oh my God, it's such a kind of a long journey if you start another company. But during that row, and I'm sure you have a lot of questions about it, during that row, I realized that it's these uncomfortable moments in life, both physically and mentally, that have been most gratifying and rewarding in my life, and including that row, by the way. And so during that row, it just hit me. No, absolutely. It's not even up for question. It's not even up for question. This opportunity to help millions of people, it may be hard, but it makes life honestly worth living. So straight after the row, off we went.
Now, you said you're a triathlete. The last I checked, that was running, cycling, swimming. That doesn't include rowing. So how did you prep for a 2,700 mile row?
Yeah, you are absolutely right. The traditional triathlon does not include rowing. And contrary to what a lot of people think, I had never done any rowing before. No rowing before. So it was kind of a 6 months from zero to 100 kilometers an hour, 60 miles an hour in rowing from January 2014 to June, July 2014. Obviously procuring the gear, ton of training, strength training, rowing on an erg. I think I did a 12 hours indoors, is like just as one example. Lots of also safety training. How do you survive in the ocean? Navigation, radio training, survival training. How do you get into a survival suit, jump off? But honestly, it was kind of a full-time job. Luckily, well, I don't know if it's luckily, but I wasn't working. I was kind of in between jobs and companies between Trulia and Virta. So I had time. And then, of course, my wife was part of the team, not just part of the team, but probably did more of the work and the load. But it's quite exciting, actually, from zero to launching that kind of adventure in 6 months.
Amazing.
Yeah, I can imagine how exciting that was. And your sporting achievements are super impressive, as well as your business achievements. But how do you get the right balance between those? How do you keep up all the training and run a billion-dollar company?
Yeah, Debbie, that is a good question. And I get it often, like, how do you even have the time, or how do you do? Well, the way I look at it is I would not be able to do what I do in any other way. This is actually the easier way. And what I mean by that is, from a kind of the benefit side, to me, it's always been very important that I have multiple identities, if you will, in my mind, whether that's a CEO, founder, athlete, parent, husband. And so I found it very liberating, helps with my creativity and probably mental health, that I'm not stuck with that, let's say, the founder identity, which, by the way, let's be honest, it's so easy to get sucked in. My company, its success potential, its valuation or whatnot is my self-identity. So I think it's very, very dangerous. It works when things are going up and to the right, but that never lasts forever. So that's kind of the one of the benefits. And then just practically speaking, the physical benefits of treating my mind and body like an Olympic athlete. I'm not an Olympic athlete, but I'm treating it like that. I'm absolutely convinced there's no way I could have delivered and been a founder operator for 20 plus years now. So that's the other one. So it actually helps me to train and perform at a pretty high level at sports. And then how to do it, it's a lot of no's. I don't do a lot of things that quote unquote normal people do, meaning I don't go to movies. You know, friends always ask, oh, you must have been traveling a lot. Not quite. I just don't have time for 3 dinners a week or 2 or even 1. So I say no to a lot of things by choice that maybe normal folks do. And so I just focus on a few things. It's Virta mission and my sports and then family and friends.
Yeah, so it's kind of a question of focus, I guess. And I really like that idea that, you know, your sporting achievements actually help you with your business achievements, and it's getting that kind of physiological and psychological balance into that. That's amazing. And what other lessons from elite sport can be used in a business context?
Yeah, I think a lot of things. Let's say one, let's just start from this. I think the mind, that people talk about mind and body. I mean, it's, as a physicist, I think of it's all the same molecules floating around. So it's one and the same. And so I do think to perform at a high level in anything, you really have to treat yourself very well, you know, like an athlete, basically. And so sometimes I use this example of if you have Olympic Games tomorrow, you aren't going to pull an all-nighter the night before.
So true.
Right?
So true.
So I think that's one thing. It's much easier to learn that as an athlete and then apply that to kind of being a business person or knowledge worker. So I think that's one. The second one is oftentimes in sports, it's easier to measure and then iterate and know if you're on the right track. And so I've certainly learned the importance of knowing what to measure, both process and outcome metrics, and then to take that to business, and having that feedback loop is so important. In most areas. That's second. And then the third one, in sports, and I think in business sometimes, so oftentimes the goal is like, oh my God, it's achieving something. And then once you kind of succeed once or twice or reach a milestone, you know, the focus is all on the celebration or that milestone. When in fact, it's all the process. And the best athletes, what I found and what I've applied in sports is, every race and every event, yeah, you want to win. But that result, the second you finish the event, to me becomes absolutely secondary. I always sit down and write down literally, what 3 things can I improve for next time? What 3 things can I improve for next time? And I think applying that, call it a growth mindset or sort of a constant iteration loop, separates the long-term sustainable, quote-unquote, winners and people who can advance on a mission and progress versus the ones who quote unquote got once lucky and then they just high five and, you know, a month or quarter or a year or 2 later crumple. So that mindset of it's all about the process, it's all about improving in a process and enjoying that process more than the occasional win has been very helpful for me, both sports and business.
Sammy, you grew up in Finland. At what point did you think I need to make this move to the US, and why did you make that move?
Yeah, no, it is true. I grew up in Finland on a farm, and you might say pretty humble beginnings. Parents didn't even go to high school, so I was, you know, picking potatoes and taking care of a few animals and going to school, running my bike to school, and kind of very simple. So I certainly wasn't thinking about leaving Finland or Silicon Valley at age, you know, 10. But I'd say as I went to university and started to see that there's a bigger world out there, I was obsessed about building things and starting things and dreaming of what could be. And the life and the glamour, perhaps, of Silicon Valley. I saw it through the pages of magazines, whether that's the Fast Company or Business 2.0. By the way, many magazines that don't even exist anymore in like late 90s. So in my mind, Silicon Valley is as an entrepreneur and as someone who wanted to build things, it literally was like the Hollywood for actors. Most European top actors and actresses want to go to Hollywood. I grew up in Finland. There's a lot of kids, many boys, obviously, who are hockey players. Most of them want to go to NHL. Like that is the kind of ultimate arena to test what you're capable of. And so to me, Silicon Valley, I'd say in my early 20s, mid-20s, was that kind of, oh my God, that is my NHL. That's my NHL. I want to get there somehow. So I think that kind of pulled me in early 2000s.
And you've already mentioned that this, you know, Virto Health isn't your first successful startup. Talk us through how that first one came about and how you kind of exited that and why you thought it'd be a good idea to try again and do another one.
Yeah, it is true. I did also start a software company in Finland, which ended up being somewhere between a modest success and failure, depending on how you look at it. Didn't go too far, but after coming to America 2003, I was very driven by this idea of I'm going to build something, anything that's of use for someone else. Fulfill my Silicon Valley dream effectively. And so I got lucky that another European, actually, someone from Great Britain who went to Oxford, another physicist, Pete Flint, was my classmate at Stanford, where we were both doing an MBA at the business school. So we founded Trulia, this real estate marketplace company, which was an amazing 10-year journey as, again, two Europeans, two immigrants, two physicists, two residential real estate outsiders in America, started this company. And, about 8 years later, after founding, took it public on New York Stock Exchange and scaled it, created thousands of jobs, tens of millions of people were using it. And it still warms my heart to hear from people who use it today that, oh, I found my house or my apartment on Trulia. And then eventually 2014, formally 2015, truly emerged with our peer or competitor Zillow. So it was an amazing journey. And at which point I had left my operational role. So that was that journey. And then, as I already mentioned before, I did not have the plan to start another company. I felt like, oh, well, that was an amazing chapter in my life. And I wonder what next. And then this discovery that type 2 diabetes could be reversed and we could help millions of people lose weight nutritionally was sort of accidental discovery. And so I'd say I'm an accidental serial entrepreneur and very happy for that.
That is a very happy accident, yes. And back to Virto Health, you've gone through quite a few rounds of funding. And I think the last one was $133 million Series E, which was a few years back. How has that money been invested to date?
Yeah, and well. First, I would say, I personally think like money raised for a company, it's sort of a vanity metric, and unfortunately, companies often like celebrate like, oh, we've raised this much money. I'd love to change the world with no outside capital, with as small of a team as possible, and I also tell my team like, remember, all the money that we've raised or might raise. It's not money that we just burn. It is like a mortgage, but it's a mortgage that doesn't have a 5% rate. It has more like 50 to 100% every year rate. So it's a huge responsibility. And I don't take it lightly that people have given us that or invested that money. But to your question, why did we do it? Well, quite frankly, we needed it for a number of things. And so this is basically two things. One is product development. So building this telemedicine platform and all the AI, and we have a very large product surface area because it's used by our patients, it's used by our medical doctors, it's used by our coaches, it's used by some other internal folks. We also have business clients like employers and health plans reporting to them. So we have a huge product surface area. So one area is just product development, which is effectively salaries to software engineers and artificial intelligence experts. And then the other area is just building the what I call the commercial go-to-market machine. And that is very complicated in US healthcare. So you have long sales cycles, selling to self-insured employers like maybe UPS or United or United Airlines. These kinds of large employers that we work with. So it takes time. Sales cycles can be a year, year and a half, 2 years. And so you need a lot of capital for that. Fortunately, we still have a big chunk of all the capital we raised in the bank, so we haven't used it all. But that's where the money has gone. So it's been an investment into making Virta work and getting Virta to a point where we are today.
Excellent. And so what's the actual structure of the business now?
Yeah, well, so on a kind of a product side, our product is delivered fully virtually. So we use telemedicine to help people reverse type 2 diabetes and lose weight. And individual patients get a medical doctor, a coach, and lots of obviously software-served content to help them make the right lifestyle changes in a highly, highly individualized way to reverse their type 2 diabetes and help lose weight. And just to mention briefly our outcomes, I like to say that we deliver Ozempic, this GLP-1 drug, Ozempic-like results without the drugs and their costs and side effects. So people lose 13% of body weight on average, and majority of our patients get off of insulin who have type 2 diabetes. 60% of our patients in 1 year have diabetes reversed. And many of our patients, which is my proudest moment, to have permanently tattooed this logo that I have on my t-shirt on their skin after we reverse their type 2 diabetes. So that's kind of this on a patient-facing structure and a little bit outcomes. And then, on the business side. So we're privately held, good scale, still is growing very well, and not announcing here anything, but I think we have a IPO for Virta as well in the foreseeable future, I would say. So we're in a good place, growth company, sort of a pre-IPO stage, and excited to keep scaling. Still day one for us.
So is your business all virtual, or do you have any kind of physical locations where you have employees sited, that sort of thing?
Yeah, well, the delivery and the product and the treatment is all virtual, meaning we can take patients from anywhere, and all the interaction with the Virta team is through a screen, through a smartphone or computer. Obviously, we monitor biomarkers remotely on a daily basis, so we get even data from what's happening in their bloodstream, which is key to individualizing our type 2 diabetes reversal and weight loss offering. So the product itself is fully virtual. So our patients don't have to come to Virta Clinic other than online, which is very helpful. In terms of the company itself and us, we had two main offices when COVID hit. It was San Francisco, California was our headquarters, and where I co-founded the company. And then Denver, Colorado was our other major hub. Those are still our major hubs. And in fact, we moved our formal headquarters to Denver, Colorado in the last year or so. So we have those two major offices. And then we have a large chunk of our team is remote or remote first. So I would call us a hybrid, where we hire people from anywhere in the US, and most of the work happens quote unquote remotely, but we do have two in-person offices. And I personally am a huge believer in human interaction. It's fun, you build trust, in many ways you're more effective. And you know, business also happens with people you trust, people you like. So I think the hybrid approach is, at least for now, it's the best of both worlds.
Yeah.
Did you choose Denver for any particular reason? Because it's often kind of described as the next Silicon Valley, isn't it?
Yeah, well, isn't it that many cities want to claim they're the next Silicon Valley?
That is true.
My Helsinki and my native Finland. We did choose Denver for a particular reason. First, I should say we've had an office in Denver for many, many years, since I think 2016. So there was a foundation on that. But Denver, Colorado is a great place to have a tech company and have a major office or headquarters there. It's actually very good access to talent, particularly healthcare and healthcare tech and even healthcare services. So it's good access to talent. Second is, It's very good quality of life. It's both affordable access to, you know, sports and other things. So it's very attractive for employees. And I noticed, and we noticed in the years leading into COVID, that many of our San Francisco-based employees who visited our Denver office actually ended up moving there 6 months later. And so San Francisco, unfortunately, has priced itself out in many ways for a lot of employees. So that's the second one. And then the third one is just practically, it's very central, you know, in America. It's easy to fly east, west, up, north, south. So it's very central. So so there's a very good tech and healthcare tech ecosystem. So it just seemed like a great fit for us. Good for business. And pretty pro-business state. I should promote Colorado a little bit here.
So, Sammy, you mentioned that you have two hubs and you also have remote workers. So you've got this lovely hybrid approach to working now. What approach have you taken to establish a company culture across that footprint?
Yeah, I think establishing and setting up company culture is one of the most important things a founder CEO can do and should do, because culture always happens. So it's not like culture doesn't emerge. The only choice you have as a leader or founder, especially, is do you want to consciously shape it or just let it organically happen? And of course, the former is always better. And so, you know, we started thinking about culture and values way before remote and COVID. So literally our very first offsite as a team of 8 or 9 or 10 employees in 2015 was about defining values for the company and what kind of culture do we want to build? What kind of culture that feels like us, but then also helps our business forward, given what we do, reverse type 2 diabetes and address obesity. So that's kind of step one, that I think it's very important that founders and CEOs define it very early on. And then practically speaking, then you have to implement it. I think the most important is living up to the values yourself and sort of quote unquote training new team members so they live up to the values by themselves, because the most important thing is imitation. So like if we all travel to a new country, we pretty quickly feel like, this kind of culture and values is a little different. And if we live there a year, 2, 5, 10, 15, we kind of start to imitate that. And the same happens in companies. So I'd say the most important way to implement values and culture is to live up to them all the time, and then others will imitate. And then lastly, I would say, obviously, we have a number of practices and that sort of amplify the values that we have. So who is promoted, who's sometimes fired, part of that is tied to our values and culture. Did you live up to them or not? Because that's probably the most powerful tool. Who gets promoted, others want to imitate that. And if who is asked to leave the company, you probably don't want to imitate that. Then we have Verton Values Awards quarterly for our team members. We have kind of virtual channel, Slack channel, where we give gratitude to people and usually tie that to one value or another. So we have a number of that kind of practices where we explicitly tie the values into our operations and in our performance. But yeah, it is very, very important to, I think, define values and then try to do things that kind of keep the company culture as consistent as it can. Of course, it evolves when company scales and grows.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and when it comes to internal communications and keeping your employees engaged in the business and informed about the culture, how involved are you in that process?
I personally think I'm ridiculously involved, and this kind of relates to implementing the values. As a leader, like, I think my job is to make sure that kind of how I think about the business, how I think about the values, how I think about the decision making, how I think about the direction, and how to make tough decisions is somehow absorbed by the entire organization in such a way that if, hopefully not, but if I get hit by a bus for many years down the road, the company still looks and feels like the CEO or the founder. I think that is my job. So I'm very, very involved, and I'll give you examples. I send a weekly team letter that I write every week for the whole company. And there's like a deep dive topic, and then some certain metrics are shared. But it's basically a letter I sent to the company. So I've written now you know, 400, I think I wrote the 442nd or something like that last night. So that's one example. We have a sort of a Monday all hands for the whole company where, by the way, we always have Virta patient that joins every week, but there's a little CEO section. So it's just a 30, 35 minutes, but I have it there. Then I have sort of executive leadership meetings on a weekly basis. We have a large leadership team meeting every couple of weeks. I talk there. And then the classic management by walking around, try to be sufficiently visible, both virtually, but then also at our different offices and events. And, you know, I just came from San Francisco yesterday, just as an example. So I think I'm a ridiculously involved, and it is by design. I like it, just to state the obvious, hopefully, but I think it's very important. I think it's very important people here. That doesn't mean I meddle in every decision, but I feel like I need to sort of hug the company and the team with the way I want to shape the company. And I think it's very important.
That sounds great. Sammy, I mentioned at the top of the show, you know, in our previous interviews, we've now interviewed 35 unicorn CEOs, so you are number 36. The first one we did that we recorded was actually back in December 2019, which seems, you know, a lifetime ago now, since we've had COVID in between and what have you. What I was just wondering, though, is now that you are the first of our kind of new season of guests that we're doing for 2024, so we're kind of committed to this series title now in terms of Unicorn Leaders. But is the term unicorn, is it still as relevant as it was 5 years ago?
I hate the term. I hate the term. I thought, and all credit to, you know, the people who invented it and use it, I hate the term, and I don't think it was ever relevant. And here's why. I think we as founders and builders, what we can affect is operating and scaling the company and advancing on a mission. In my mind, valuations come and go. And I like this. I think it was Warren Buffett who said that the stock market, the equity market, short term is a voting machine and long term it's a weighing machine. Meaning short term popularities come and go and valuations and valuation multiples kind of go up and down. But what we operators can affect is creating a very heavy, a large company in terms of revenues and profits and impact on a mission. So I personally, I feel that my scorecard is how far have we advanced on a mission? Like how many people have we helped, which then correlates or translates into revenues and profits. So creating a large impact on the mission, I'd celebrate that and I'd tie that into the unicorn name rather than the dollar valuation of market cap. So that's kind of where my, I guess, emotional response came, that I hate that. That said, now that I founded and built two unicorns, if you want to have a headline interview, two-time unicorn founder to get more clicks, go for it. I personally, this focus on valuation numbers, particularly as private companies, I think it's kind of misleading to me. That's my personal opinion.
I love that mission focus. That's a great approach.
Yeah. Maybe you can also measure it based on how many of your patients have got the tattoo. Because I doubt there's many other unicorns that we've interviewed that can claim that.
Exactly. But quite honestly, I think our society is so kind of capitalism is great, but it's so money focused. But again, I would say valuation multiples is kind of wet, like a weather. Sometimes it's rainy, sometimes it's sunny. And if the scorecard happens to be like, what's the valuation in any point of time, I think it's very misguided. I think the scorecard should be how much positive impact has your for-profit company had on the chosen path or chosen mission. And long term, that will correlate with the scaling revenues and profits and broadly the value that you have created. So I feel actually very strongly about this.
Looking ahead, Sammy, what's the focus for the next couple of years for Virta Health? And do you have any plans to expand outside of the US?
Well, yes and yes and yes. I think So let's again take a step back. I think I mentioned in the beginning, we're on a mission to solve probably our biggest health epidemic, that is type 2 diabetes and obesity. And our stated mission, reverse type 2 diabetes in 100 million people. So there's today, there's something like 500 million people globally with type 2 diabetes.
Wow.
And multiple billion people globally who are obese. And today, the companies, I'm not going to mention names, but they're pharmaceutical companies that are addressing type 2 diabetes and obesity. They're basically prescribing drugs to treat the symptom of these diseases, such as high blood sugar for diabetes. But the disease isn't going away. So there's a massive, massive, massive opportunity to build a evidence-based lifestyle version of these treatments that actually addresses the root cause of type 2 diabetes and obesity. And that's what we do, and that's what we've done. So to your question, what are we kind of focused on? Honestly, the opportunity ahead of us is a multi-decade opportunity. We've now proven that what we do works. We've now proven that we have a business model that works in the US. We have nearly 500 large clients. We had 20 just a couple of years ago, and more than 100,000 people, patients have benefited from the Virta treatment. And so number one focus for us is the hard work and fun work of scaling the impact. So I'd say that's sort of the number one focus for us. And that it's not trivial for a company that has medical doctors and coaches and AI and software and patient safety and patient outcomes in our fingertips all the time. So scaling and executing first in the US, and then absolutely we want to go international. Then secondly, in terms of the sort of exciting new and newish opportunities for us, I would say one is we've used machine learning since 2017 and built internal models to treat patients better and so forth. But obviously these large language models, that type of AI is very exciting for us as well. So application of AI in all internal processes, but particularly in patient-facing care and tools for our care team. So that's one very exciting opportunity for all of us, and we're kind of in the middle of it. So that's one. And then a second one is these GLP-1 drugs like Ozempic and Wegovy and Zepbound and Mounjaro and so forth. That has brought massive attention to obesity, which we've been doing since day one. But until about 2 years ago, 18 months ago, the insurance companies and employers' interest in investing and addressing obesity was kind of a footnote, very limited. And now it has completely changed. So that opportunity to address obesity in a sustainable and cost-effective way, where the drugs may or may not be, or likely will be a part or small part of a toolkit, but again, addressing nutritionally the root cause, being a good alternative for these weight loss drugs, and then also being a good off-ramp of these weight loss drugs. This is super exciting, kind of an extra opportunity for us. So those are the two, AI and addressing obesity in this new world of very expensive GLP-1 drugs, are exciting new things, if you will, that we're very focused on. And then attitude-wise, it's my job to always keep the team thinking, it's still day one. Going back to the sports analogy, that the moment you think you've arrived and you've succeeded, guess what? That's the start of a downhill. So always try to keep the it's day one attitude.
It's a great way to finish. We've got one final question for you, Sammy, and that is, any fitness tips for our listeners?
Oh my God, that's dangerous. This is probably going to get the most engagement for the podcast. People are going to be disagreeing, like, what is he saying? Who is he? Okay, first caveat, I'm not a medical doctor and I don't act one on the internet. So take this with a grain of salt, talk to your physician. I think for most people, I'd say, here's my three step, like how to become healthier and likely fitter. And so here's probably my three top tips. One, as it relates to food, eliminate all possible visible sugar and processed carbohydrates from your diet. And it's easier to eat zero sugar than kind of a little bit. So that's one. That's my only nutrition tip. Eliminate all sugar, particularly liquid sugars, including juices and sodas. So that's one tip. Second one is sleep is the best performance enhancing drug. So simple things is like sleep in the dark, sleep in a quiet, don't have caffeine in the afternoon, and to the extent you can, wake up without alarm. It doesn't usually work, doesn't work for me either, but sleep is this, prioritize sleep. This idea that, oh, I can grind with 4 hours sleep, it's horrible, you're killing yourself. Sleep is a mental health tool, it's a focus tool, it's also a diet tool, because if you sleep well, you don't have cravings and so forth. So that's my second tip. Sleep is the best performance enhancing drug you can have as a human, as an athlete and so forth, and it's legal. And third one is just for exercise, I would say, similar to zero sugar, I would say move every day. So if you aren't a hardcore fitness enthusiast or athlete, kind of a simple way to get things going is make a decision that every day I do something, even if it's literally just 5 minute walk or two stairs up and down or something like that, or two floors up and down. So every day something. Doesn't need to be too complicated. How many days a week do I lift weights or this or that? Make a decision that every day before I go to bed, I'll do something active. Whether that's a 1K run, half a K walk, or I don't know, lift a kettlebell or whatever, but something. So there's my three things. No sugar, prioritize sleep, and move every single day. Any whatever kind of movement. So there you go. Free advice. Debate.
I feel that was very targeted at me, actually. I've got a lot to do there. That was brilliant. No, I don't sleep enough. I have too much sugar and I don't exercise enough. So thank you for that. I'll get on to all three of those straight away. Listen, it's been absolutely fantastic. We've loved spending time with you. We've been chatting for kind of like 45 minutes. So Sami Inkinen, thank you so much for taking the time to join us online today. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Listen, we'd love to hear your comments on today's chat. You can do that by sharing them on any of our social media feeds. Those are all linked from the top of our website at csuitepodcast.com, where you'll also find all our previous shows and supporting show notes, plus links to where you can follow us on the likes of Spotify and Apple. And if you've liked what you heard, please do give us a positive rating and review. If you are a unicorn leader yourself and you'd like to be part of this series, please do get in touch via the contact form on the website. Plus, of course, anyone can get in touch with any feedback you may have. And finally, you can also find both me, Russell Goldsmith, and Debbie West on LinkedIn. But for now, thanks for listening and goodbye.